appreciate this opportunity. It made me to go back and look up some old slides I hadn't looked at for 10 years, because some of the work that I'll be reporting on was done in the 90s when I was working with SEOT and the Bean Research Program for Eastern Africa, or Bean Research Network. With on-farm research, I see it as a continuum. It involves quite a wide range of activities. Researcher trials conducted on-farm, but also farmers' own research, where they're stimulated to do some experimentation on their own. It could involve some on-station research as well, in my opinion, if it's somehow driven by the farmers responding to their needs. And a lot of it has to do with the variation in the farmer's role. To what extent are they involved in identifying the research topic, in planning the research, in the management of the trials and data collection, and finally interpretation of the results. And again, it's quite a wide range of situations. And as I say, it could include on-station research, especially if it's some on-station research and then farmers are brought onto the research station to look at the treatments and then make selections from those to test on their own fields. And some of that work was, to my knowledge, was first done by Louise Sperling, an anthropologist with the CG system in the late 80s, where she would bring farmers in to look at breeders' trials, advanced yield trials. Those farmers would select varieties that they thought looked promising, and they'd go into on-farm trials. And another, something called the mother trial, baby trial approach is somewhat similar with agronomic practices, where again, farmers would come and look at a researcher's trial, which maybe had 20 different treatments in it, and they would select the ones that they wanted to investigate on farm. So I'll talk about three experiences with on-farm research that I've been involved in. One is from the 90s when I was with, as I said, the CIOTB program and based in Uganda, working throughout Eastern and Southern Africa. With that, the farmers had a big role. More recently, I've been working with a narrower mandate through INSERMIL. INSERMIL is the International Sorghum and Millet and Small Grains Collaborative Research Project. It works as the mandate amongst the CRISP for several crops, including sorghum, pearl millet, teff in Ethiopia, finger millet in East Africa, and fonio in West Africa. I'll also speak a bit about economic analysis or consideration in economic analysis for resource-poor farmers, and also about the interpretation of the results and the risk of us rejecting profitable alternatives. An important thing for on-farm research in East Africa is having good shade trees. And the reason is you spend a lot of time in meetings with farmers, starting with their diagnosis, characterization of their situation, identifying problems, prioritizing problems, planning the research, and finally, at the end of each cropping season, the interpretation of the results. So the shade trees give a comfortable venue to meet. Our approach was to, with this, at this time in the 90s, and again, this particular approach was to work with communities, interested farmers and interested communities, but communities that were representative of a larger area. It was research. Primarily, it was primarily to get information that could be applied and extended through extension means to a broader area. We generally initiated this work with communities with the intent that it was going to carry on for several years, not infinitely. We knew it would not go on forever due to different things, but at least for several years. And again, farmers had major roles in the selection of research topics and the interpretation of the results. And through our Bean Research Network, we finally eventually had communities in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, K Kenya, Madagascar, Tanzania, and Uganda. In some countries, just one such community working with the researchers from the national institution. In some other countries, it was several. This particular photo is from with one of the groups in western Kenya, Kisii area of Kenya. As I recall, in this case, they're looking at a maize variety trial. So to initiate this research with the community, typically it involved 4 or 5 days of meetings with them. And we would do what we called participatory exercises. And they'd be different types of exercises to first characterize their situations, looking at their soil types. And the one community had 11 different soil types that they themselves identified and had uses for, could describe, etc. But also to characterize their cropping systems, which are generally very complex, typically 6 important agronomic crops plus numerous minor crops, the livestock, the infrastructure, land use, monthly labor demand, etc. Then to go on with the diagnosis and prioritization of the problems, identification of research topics that they were interested to work in, and then to develop the operational plan as to who would do what and where and when, etc. In this photo, there's a group of farmers during the characterization and diagnosis, and I don't think I was around, I got this photo from somewhere else, but they were maybe doing some participatory diagramming, for instance, showed the distribution of rainfall or labor demand throughout the year or something like this. And this shot was from western Kenya, the Bukoba area, where a lady is using the counter method to quantify the importance of some different options. It might have been the importance of different weed species or crop species or soil types or something like this. The topics that were addressed varied with communities, but include variety testing for several crops, fertilizer and manure use, integrated pest management. There was cases for bean, banana, cassava that I can think of, agroforestry, cover crops, reduced tillage, grain storage, forage production, and erosion control. So again, the researchers went in with openness, you know, to address problems that were of interest to the farmers, the community, and then they would, those researchers made contact could bring in other researchers as needed. And generally, we weren't talking about a green revolution. Someone brought up the term of evolution or green evolution. It was more like this. It was not to completely change their system, but to build on what they had, the strengths of what they had, and to find opportunities for improvement. The trials then were typically farmer managed. Generally, the 3 hours were practiced, but not always. And I'll get to those exceptions. Farmers as well as researchers made observations because we weren't just interested in the technical suitability of the technologies, the practices, but also how they fit in with the farmer's socioeconomic situation. And then finally, the reporting and evaluation of the results. There would be statistical evaluation or analysis, but we also had the farmers give their evaluation interpretations. This is from Madagascar. Boud Rabari was the lead researcher, which is with the National Agriculture Research Program there. And they're evaluating a climbing bean trial. The photo on the right is also from Madagascar, and here the lady's using a counter method, and again, I think it's for bean variety trial. She probably has varieties on one axis and some bean phenotypic characteristics on the other axis, such as grain type, growth habit, yield, maybe cooking time if they took the observations that far. And so she's using her counters to indicate the importance of the different traits within the varieties. Results of work on erosion control. This is from the highlands of western Kenya. One of the treatments was vetergrass that this farmer was interested to try. And here is southwestern Uganda, looking at the use of stover from maize or sorghum as thrash barriers to stabilize the hillside, reduce potential for erosion. integrated pest management. This work was from Western Kenya, but to look at soil fertility management practices where bean root rots were severe. We knew that early plant nutrition was important to tolerance to the root rots, and this was a trial to look at a number of different practices. I should say we did get quite several good journal publications from this work. Not all of it led to journal publications, but it was done with sufficient rigor that it was publishable, although that was not the primary objective. There was quite a bit of work with soil-improving legumes. This photo of Mucuna in the upper left corner, and Crotalaria ucruca here, and the Mucuna's was one of the more promising species, or is one of the more promising species. It's easy to establish. It makes vigorous growth. It's good at suppressing the weeds. Often leaves the field quite clean so that you do not have to do any tillage or weed control before planting the next crop. Our control, at least in Uganda and some other places, was the weedy fallow. There were no herbicides used, and so as the crops matured and became less competitive with the weeds would come forth, they harvest the crops, and the weeds would deplete the moisture until the start of the next rain. And they had, you know, the benefits of cycling nutrients, giving cover to the crop, the soil, and there were palatable species out there that cattle could graze. And it was a mixture of species, some deep-rooted, some shallow-rooted, etc. But that was the control. And generally, these systems were nitrogen deficient enough that there was good benefit to substituting the weedy fallow with leguminous cover crop, green manure type crops. So from this work, we had several intended benefits. One was the obvious was to address those problems that were a priority to the farmer, get good information that could be extrapolated to other areas and disseminated. There was also the potential for farmer-to-farmer dissemination, and that was probably best illustrated by them disseminating seed of new varieties. And it was interesting, we'd find a few farmers that would maybe give seed to 20 different farmers. Most of them would pass it on to one or two farmers. But definitely that was a important benefit of the process. And we were also very interested to see that through the process, farmers would become more capable in their own experimentation and adaptive management. And there were some examples that came out from this. Here, for instance, we never had any formal experimentation on any of this, but farmers got interested and they would try it on their own. But here it's a jack bean or a Cannibalia species, which was sown into maize at the second weeding. The maize is now matured. There's still some soil water. The Cannibalia is making some growth and producing some high nitrogen biomass, which should be a benefit to the next crop. Here it's a sweet potato. The sweet potato is typically grown on mounds in this area, and they would plant Cannibalia in between the mounds, so you could get some green manure production without much competition to the sweet potato crop. With Mucuna under banana, and also Dolichos lublubla under banana, this again was all farmer experimentation. And first they started off, they had too high of a plant density and too close to the bananas, and they found it to be too competitive with bananas. But with that observation, they say, well, let's reduce this down, let's keep the plants away from the banana, and especially where they could cut it and feed it to dairy animals, it worked out a very nice cover crop. Generally, these were not replicated, at least not in the field. Some were replicated from farm to farm, and then over time, there was not even a control as part of it in the same field. You'd have to look at another field or past experience with the crop as the control. But we found it very informative, both from the farmer's observations as well as the researcher observations. This is an interesting case of farmer experimentation. The species is Tephrosia vogeli. And Tephrosia, as a toxin, it contains rotenone. It's an indigenous species, so it's around. People know about it. But a major problem that farmers have is mole rats, which burrows underground. It feeds on roots. Does a lot of damage to cassava and sweet potato crops, as well as some others. Well, we brought the idea to them. We said, why don't you try this? And that was the extent of our involvement in it. And several farmers did. Some planted scattered trees throughout their field, and others planted trees around the field. But they found that both approaches have worked to get rid of the mole rats. We knew from other work that the Tephrosia was good at nitrogen fixation, and we knew from other work that it could host root knot nematodes. Well, farmers got pretty excited about it, but we did realize that it was raising this pest problem, which was quite important to dry bean production and even to a lesser extent maize production. So we had to put that in the extension method. So we didn't have any formal research on this, but we did evolve it into an extension method, which a number of organizations picked up on, as well as with some of the other work that farmers did. So this is an approach that it does take quite a bit of time, and it means working with quite a broad mandate. It might take 20 to 25% of a research position to support Chich on farm research with the community, and more if they do not have good arrangements locally for facilitation. With some of the people involved in it, the researchers, they would identify facilitators in the village who could look after things, who could assist the farmers in putting in trials and collecting the data, so the researcher did not have to be there very often. In other cases, each time something had to be done, there was a team that went out from the research center to look after it, and that was much more costly. It does require someone who has a broad systems mandate and knowledge of systems, sufficient seniority that can bring in other experts when they're needed, ability to gain the respect of community members. They have to have that interest. It's a lot of interaction with people, so that interest and personality for the human dimensions, and good access to transport. Now, I don't know if any of these efforts are continuing at this time. I haven't bothered to follow up. It would be interesting to do this, and especially to see if this the adaptive management ability of farmers has improved in those villages compared to others, if that's something that has carried on. But I never had opportunity to follow up on it, and I don't know if anyone else does. I did review a proposal recently from a researcher in East Africa, and some of the methodology was there. They were proposing to use some of this methodology in the research. What we have now with InSurMill, as I said, we're working with a narrower mandate, and it's a more extensive approach. We're doing trials, more places. It's focused on fewer problems. It still involves farmer groups. It's still farmer-managed trials, but generally the farmer row is smaller than with the other case. There are field days involved, so there is that extension component. It is an approach that requires less researcher time. The collaborator in Uganda has been very good at identifying such research or such facilitators as these young people, just rural youth, young farmers who he pays on a per trial basis for successful implementation. And another important part of it is to build on other activities. So in this case, it's the other activity is a farmer field school. Field school is where farmers get together every 2 weeks or maybe 3 weeks to learn about some topic, and they continue this on for 1 or 2 years. It's an approach that's been supported by FAO and some other donors. The map shows the activity areas in Uganda presently. Dr. Kayizi is the main, is leading this work. This is one of his facilitators on the right. Angela is a research technician. She has just started her master's degree at Makerere University with InSurMill support. And in Uganda, the work has been primarily, with Insermill, has been primarily on soil fertility management, reduced tillage, and input supply and technology transfer. Just a result of some of the work in Uganda, I'm not presenting much for results, but these are the means from 61 on-farm trials looking at different soil fertility management practices. And we have our yield increase, not the actual yield, but the yield increase as compared to no nutrient applied, the net returns to input, and the benefit cost ratio. Now here I want to say a bit about the economic analysis. These resource poor farmers do not have access to credit. They can't borrow credit at 10% interest or something like this. They may have $20 or $30 that they have to make a decision as to how they're going to invest. They might want to use that money to recondition a bicycle. They may want to use it for house repair. They may want to use it for school fees or medical care or something like this. Or they could invest it in fertilizer. The thing is, they need to get very high returns on their investment. And typically, economists say with the poorest, we need to expect at least 100% return with that harvest. That is, we double the cost of the fertilizer. We double the cost of the input. In this case, I was saying, okay, we're not targeting the poorest, still poor farmers. I think we used a cost-benefit ratio of 50% in this case. But it does make the use of inputs much more costly. Another part of it is, because of the costly inputs, we need to identify what the best opportunities are for payback. And so we have results on response to a number of NMP for a number of crops. We see the benefit cost ratio by far is greatest for 10 kilos of N applied to dry bean, followed next by, that has a cost ratio, benefit ratio of almost 30. It's that starter fertilizer effect. After that, the nitrogen fixation takes over in the dry bean. Whereas our next best is with phosphorus applied to peanuts, and then nitrogen for maize and sorghum isn't bad either. Some work with reduced tillage and where we're replacing plowing with glyphosate application. And these and some other results have been published in Agronomy Journal. More recently, we're getting into climate variability in Ethiopia. And our starting point there is the farmer's present decision system. And in this area, they can plant over a four-month period, starting in March all the way to August, because of the nature of the rainfall. And so they're making decisions during that time as to when to plant, if they should plant, when to plant, what to plant, which varieties to plant, whether they use fertilizer, etc. And so it's really quite complex. And so that's our starting point. And we also ask them, and we started by going out and interviewing them and learning about the decision system. We ask them also, do you have any indicators of approaching weather conditions? And with the one community, they said, yes, this bird, the Abyssinian ground hornbill, it's got a certain behavior when the onset of rains are near. So if they see this bird acting in a certain way, they're confident that the rains are going to start soon. That hasn't been verified, but you know, it's interesting local knowledge. This young man here has just started his master's degree with our support at Haramaya University, and as one response to the climate variability, he's looking at dry soil planting, both with field trials as well as crop growth simulation models. Just a few words on statistics. Science, the null hypothesis, and on-farm research. In science, we test the null hypothesis, right? The claim under investigation is not true. Our alternative practice isn't considered true until the null hypothesis is proven false. The null hypothesis is our current situation, the state of nature, the currently used practice. In research, we're comparing something to that. We like to be 95% confident that our finding of the null hypothesis to be false is not due to coincidence. although lower probabilities are often justified. We can then agree that the null hypothesis is false within confidence levels and that the alternative practice may be true. But this approach puts the claim, the burden of proof on those who are asserting the alternative claim. So the question is, how relevant is this to on-farm research? And what should our alpha level be? If the on-farm research is being conducted for the use of information to be used locally for added profitability or some other benefit. That is, the research is not being done to add to the global body of knowledge about the subject. And so we have our distribution of observations that we might get, our population. And we have it for our normal practice. And we have it for our alternative practice. We have our area of type 1 error. But then we see the means look quite different. And here with the type, you know, we would say, yes, they are different. They're statistically different. But it could be very well that when we're making our observations on the second treatment that they're falling over in this area. And then we would say, no, it's not different. Often with on-farm research, because of the low CVs, we can detect differences which are economically, but they're not statistically significant with a probability of 0.05 or 0.1 or sometimes even 0.2. So a question is, what level should be we using? What probability level in assessing our results? So thank you, and is there time for questions?
We have time for questions. Charlie?
Yes. You make an interesting point there with your last comments on statistics, because, you know, there was a session yesterday where there was no statistical difference, but someone put up their hand and said, well, my farmers would say 2 bushels is significant to them. And that almost behooves that we shouldn't be reporting the actual values. We should say that this treatment versus this treatment is not significant. And then in general, the yields were in, you know, X range, so that people get a feel for that, yes, you're in the ballpark or not.
Yes, we do want to do the analysis of variance. We want to look at the variability that's out there. If we find that the variability is really extreme, then we know that there's a problem and we shouldn't even be looking at the economics of it. But if it's somewhat reasonable and testing significant at 0.2, for instance, and it's economically showing an advantage, you know, I would be very reluctant to say that, no, there's no difference.
But if you turn that around and it's not significant difference, but it shows up on the chart for the demonstration of, you know, new practice is 2 bushels better, but it's not significantly different, but somebody's going to say, well, that's worth $24 to me on my soybeans, for instance, and yet it's not significantly different.
Right.
So you have a huge problem because the general farmer doesn't understand interpretation of not significance.
Right, and that's something that we need to give thought to, yeah.
Tell them where to say.
Exactly. But then don't report the numbers.
You don't know if they're the same or not. Yeah. Yet if you claim they're the same, you might be telling just as false a story.
Well, we're always making our statement within confidence limits. The question is, how wide should those confidence limits be? And I'm thinking where we're working to get knowledge to be applied locally and where our main thing is economic or some other benefit, we can accept that a wider confidence level than we would if we're publishing in a journal.
We have a comment right here.
I was just thinking that, you know, one of the values of publishing is that research is rigorous enough to be published often influences policy. I wondered, do you ever sort of take promising farmer innovations and then do on-station trials? Or, I know you've been good at publishing the on-farm research, too.
We have, and with the work in Africa, we certainly did, yes. Yeah. It would have been nice to do more, it's just always limited resources.
Other question over here.
Well, I just got a comment on the previous thing. I mean, we always quantify what type 1 error, but we don't quantify the type 2 error. So, you know, it's hard enough to convince farmers that the type 1 error, you know, the alpha or whatever is here for that, but if we had to also power the test, that we would be
Everybody hear that comment? Can you say that again?
Well, I mean, you can either declare something false when it's true or true when it's false, right? I mean, statisticians are going to play better than me, but we usually only do quantify one of those errors. And when we deal with our public, it's hard enough to describe one error, much less two errors. And if we had two errors up there, or power or alpha, you know, it would be a lot harder to communicate. But we should probably be doing it.
We're in discussion.
We are now in discussion, so we can, any one of our three speakers and all amongst ourselves.
Thank you for bringing up the topic of power, something I did not have before.
Can you go up to the microphone, please?
Yeah. Yeah, power, something I had no time to get to, so I didn't even add it in, but yes, if I see a comparison where it is dramatically biologically significant. I think that's something that we often forget about. We get so wrapped up in the p-value. I am not a p-value lover. So I'm being recorded right now, I guess, right now, and I'm okay with that. I am not a lover of the p-value, and I'm a statistician. So when you see something that's really biologically meaningful and you're struggling with, oh, but my p-value is this, okay, take a step back. Look at that standard error. Look at your sample size estimation. If you only had three or four replicates, you probably do not have enough power. I would be surprised if your power was over 0.5. Power meaning the type 2 error rate that this gentleman brought up. So that being said, you know, if you're really serious about wanting to be able to get a quote-unquote significant p-level, you need to have a very high power to your test. And high power, I'm talking 0.9. And so, you know, if you're interested in that, look up in some literature about how you calculate power. It involves having an idea of what your replication is, an idea of what your mean difference is that you expect to be able to test and be significant, and what your variance is going to be. And then you can calculate a prospective power analysis. You can also go ahead and calculate power after you actually run the experiment. It's called retrospective power analysis. But it's, you know, it's just a calculation. That can just tell you maybe how good or bad you did with your setup. So the thing I want to encourage here is the prospective aspect of it. So if you have an idea of what your variance is going to be, what it is you actually expect your mean difference to want to be able to say that that is statistically significant in quotes, that's the information that you need. Is there any question about that, or you want me to elaborate more, or is that good? Good, bad, or ugly? Yeah.
You can come up. When we published a paper on our methodologies,
come up and
when we published a paper on our on-farm research methodology, we included a power analysis of that data. And if you want to see how that can be done and applied to research project, on-farm research, or other research, you could go to that paper and look at it in Journal of Production Agriculture. So that's, I didn't have time to go into it either.
Exactly. we always, power always gets a back seat, and it really shouldn't.
I'm just wondering, on a long-term basis, if you start working in the on-farm research, how hard is it to keep it going if farmers get burned out? Or what's been the experience there on, you know, the long-term use of on-farm research?
There again, it's going to vary a huge amount by the individual that's involved with doing the on-farm research. Some of the people in our study period, the 8-year study period that we were involved with, were very active the whole time. Some people just did one trial, and of course that was it. But I think the researcher involvement or the support
that some of these people get to the level that they are the most comfortable with then is critical to that. And that's why the amount of on-farm testing declined after we didn't have the funding support to do all of the support of the other on-farm research that was going on. So did you want to comment about your Africa?
Well, it's been my observation in Africa as well as here that the researchers play out for some reason before the farmers do. Either the funding ends or someone gets transferred or something like that. And Keith, in the next presentation, will be talking about a program that's been going for something like 22 years, right?
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment here, Steve. Having done on-farm testing for about 30 years, to me the key is always you got to have a new treatment. Whether it's a new variety that you're bringing along, a new soil product, or whatever it is that you're testing, a new treatment for 3 years in there is what keeps farmers interested, or a city set of farmers interested, like 20 or 50 in the geographical region. Keep it new, keep it fresh. Keep farmers interested.
Kathleen, you scared me a little bit at the beginning of your presentation when you were talking about having the designs be tight. And we have situations where we set out a protocol and Farmer X wants to add in a couple of his treatments and Farmer Y wants to add a couple of his. And you need that because you need to keep them interested because those are usually the keen guys that drive the process. But you know, do you have any, or does anybody have any simple software that would help us to analyze that type of thing? Because I don't use SAS enough to be able to be proficient in that on an ongoing basis. I like statistics, but it won't do what you're talking about in terms of augmented designs. Is there anything out there that would help us sort of simpletons analyze data better at the farm scale level?
Find a collaborator. I should repeat the question so it's being recorded, which is the idea that the cooperator always wants to add in an extra treatment application that maybe you didn't actually hadn't planned for. That was my impetus there with the unintended feature of a hierarchical data structure. That is exactly what you are finding yourself in, is nesting. And nesting is a random effect. So you are finding yourself in the hierarchical data structure. It's, you know, don't do the square peg, round hole, you know, hammering the data with the hammer, you know, over and over with ANOVA and ordinarily squares regression, because you don't have that anymore. You have dependency issues with your data, and that's fine. There is nothing wrong with that kind of data.
Give me something to analyze it with.
You're going to have to use mixed model, multi-level modeling procedures. There's no way around it. You're going to have to investigate looking into random effects models and variance component models. And yes, SAS is very good at that. I'm not plugging any software whatsoever. That's what I utilize, but I know other people that utilize R. I know people, it's escaping my memory. It's based out of the UK, the Rothamsted Experiment Station developed it. Genstat, thank you. Genstat also can deal with that kind of data as well. And from my experience of seeing Genstat, that's not so code driven like SAS or R is. And whereas SAS and R are very code driven, SAS has, you're paying a money for that as opposed to R being freeware based. So SAS is going to have more technical support available to you than perhaps in the R community, which is just going to be based on what's available in the R community. I know that's probably not the answer to the question that you were hoping for, but there are so many tools available out there, and you know, if you need to hire a statistician at your research location, get the job search going. I know there's plenty of people that are really good at this kind of modeling.
There's no money for that.
You got to find the money for it. Write it into your grants.